The New Normal with Rod Paddock.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, and make sure to check out www.azuredevops.show for past episodes and show notes. And I'm excited that lots of people are taking me up on my open invitation to speak virtually at your .NET user groups. It's a lot of fun. And if you run a .NET user group, I'd love to get on your schedule. I have a new podcast feed. It's a video podcast called Architect Tips you might want to check out. It's the first plug. And if you're tuning in here for the first time, the Azure DevOps podcast is for developers shipping software with Microsoft technologies. And my goal for all development teams is that you're able to move fast, deliver quality, and run your systems with confidence. And if you have some specific issues you'd like help with, well, that's what we do here at ClearMeasure as an architecture company. Now, today, my guest is Rod Paddock, and he founded Dashpoint Software back in 2001 to develop high-quality custom software solutions. And with over 30 years of experience, Rod's current and past clients include Six Flags, First Premier Bank, Microsoft, Calamos Investments, U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Navy. Along with developing software, Rod also is a well-known author and conference speaker. And since 1995, Rod's given talks, training sessions, and keynotes in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. And he's also been the editor-in-chief of Code Magazine since 2001. Rod, welcome to the show. How are you, my friend?
Hey, doing all right. Thanks for having me, man. Good morning.
Absolutely. I love talking to people who are part of the old guard. Not the super old guard, people that worked at IBM in 1959, but, you know, people who remember what it was like before, say, the start menu of Windows 95.
Oh, you mean like when we were using like floppy disks and that was our mode of transport?
There you go.
I can date myself. I go back that far where it was a big deal to have the extra granularity of a screen where I had 80 columns across type of deal. So yeah, I've been there for a while.
Yeah.
So started in DOS and worked my way through where we are now.
Yep. Right. Yeah. And you got a few years on me, but when you see the pendulum swing of the industry, because you've been through enough eras where you say, ah, okay, that's not really new. It's different, but it's not new. And then you look at other things like, wait a minute, that's actually new.
You mean we've gone back to the mainframe now? Is that kind of where we are? You know, we used to have computers on our desk and that was cool. And now we're using computers in the cloud. Wasn't that? I can't say I ever worked on a mainframe because I've always been a PC person. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we live in interesting times for sure. An interesting aspect of that is doing this as long as I have, I think it's an easier learning curve just because I've gone through enough. You know, I kind of pick and choose, I guess, along the way. I don't envy developers that come out of the gate right now. It's like, what stack or set of tools do you pick? Which JavaScript framework du jour do you want? You want to use old school jQuery for doing stuff, which we still do, or do you want the newfangled Vue or the React.js or the Express.js or whatever? So luckily for me, being the editor of the magazine, I can kind of stay on top of topics just, you know, transiently, just to see what's out there and what's catching on by what my authors are interested in writing about. Those seem to be the things that are taking off. So yeah, I don't envy new developers today. It's a much tougher field than, you know, ours was a battle between Foxbase and DBase, right? That was the choice we made, or Lotus 1-2-3 versus Quattro, if anybody remembers that. Yeah, I've been around. Yeah. So
well, as the editor of Code Magazine, and that's what, 19 going on 20 years. You have a really awesome editorial in the latest edition called The New Normal, and talking about all the quarantine and no travel and all that. What are the, t- tell us, Tell us about that, because there's probably people out there that don't yet subscribe to Code Magazine.
No, you want me to pitch the magazine? Well, Code Magazine is a developer magazine for developers. I'm the editor-in-chief, and I got hired over Instant Messenger one afternoon talking with Marcus Egger, who's another software developer from the old Foxtro days. And we've always focused on the line of development developer, the person in the trenches slinging code, not on the bleeding edge, just kind of we're a little bit behind the latest bleeding curve of things. That's kind of why I pride myself on what we've done for the magazine, because we're really geared. I used myself as the example. And just FYI, the funny thing about Code Magazine is I literally was the very first paid subscriber to the magazine. I remember I was at a conference. They decided to start doing paid subscriptions, and I walked over and gave them my credit card right then, said, "I'm the first subscriber you've got." So, and here I am a few years later, I'm the editor of the magazine. And it's been a good opportunity. I really love it. I've met lots of really cool people, and we've done lots of cool stuff, and we have lots of good stuff coming still. But in terms of this latest editorial, it's very interesting to me where we are now compared to where we were when we started this year. And I call the editorial that I wrote about is the new normal, and how everything that we do is very, very different now. There's lots of things that as technical professionals, you and me, and probably a lot of your listeners, it's old hat. We already know how to video conference. We already knew about Zoom and GoToMeeting and all these different technologies, but it's also a social business. We're not just slinging code in a closet somewhere where they feed pizza under the door. We have to involve ourselves with people. And that's very different. And meeting people and doing work online it's different. It's very different. Even though I've been working at home for better part of 20 some odd years, I still travel a lot. And that's probably before the show, we were talking a little bit about that. And that's probably the biggest switch for me is I call myself I'm a road warrior, right? I'm on the road constantly, 2, 3, 4 times a month. I'm flying someplace to meet with clients that I don't necessarily have to meet with them, but FaceTime's valuable. And so those opportunities are lessened now because we have to do things like this, where we're sitting on a Zoom call doing this podcast. That's probably the biggest thing. And that was a weird experience because we drove up to South Dakota in June and I pulled the tags off my bag. And it's like, oh, we left on June 11th and the tag says March 11th was the last time I was on a plane. And it's just odd. So that's one of the things that's very different. And then the other thing that's very different, and this is going to be very mundane, but I bet a lot of your listeners will understand this. I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons since I was 13 years old. So to date myself, that's going on almost 4 decades, listeners. So I've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
And so this is a very different thing, is I like to play in person. I have a board that we play on. I have miniatures, the whole nine yards. We have all these different things that we use to play. And we get together every weekend or every other weekend for 3-4 hours and have food. And we gab about movies and different junk. But we had to move online. So there's lots and lots of tools in how you do this online. So we play with, there's apps that help you facilitate playing online, Dungeons and Dragons games and other role-playing games. And we do all this online, play other D&D, other role-playing games as well. But that's a huge difference. I like to play with people. I don't like the experience online much, but we're adapting. So, and then just building things together, you know, luckily we're in a good period of time with tools like GitHub and Slack and all these other tools. So it makes work easier, but there's still that human contact that I think we're missing. So anyway, so that's kind of rambling on, sorry, but that's kind of, our new normal is very different, you know, and you know me, Jeff, and one of my favorite hobbies is going to the movies. And
you haven't done that in a while.
I love going to the movie theaters and I love eating the popcorn and all that. And it's like, we're not going to the movie theater for a long time. So
yeah,
not till science catches up with this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Our local movie theater has a new package out to essentially rent the theater or rent the whole theater to families. And if you look at the pricing, if you have a group or birthday party, if you bought, it's basically the cost of buying 12 regular tickets and you get the whole thing. So yeah. They're like, okay, what can we do to get people to come back and pay us some money? Yeah,
it's like when you add it all up, that's like $300 or $400 for a movie. And it's like, well, I've got a really great, you know, I can go around the corner of my house here and I've got a big screen TV in there and a projector and, you know, 4K sound, the whole nine yards. I've got it all. So it's like, yeah, I'll just stay home.
Shoot, I'm coming to your house.
Yeah, luckily all that was installed quite a while ago. And, you know, it's like I'm already set for a theater at home.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, I'm looking forward to going back to the movies. Just little, it's weird, just little stuff that you do all the times without even thinking about it, right? It's like you and I going to lunch at a wing place. It's like, well, I'm not eating in a restaurant. We only order takeout because,
right,
you know, we have to concern ourselves with different things now than we ever had to, which is, that's, you know, another big issue.
Yeah, I wonder, besides the health implications, I wonder what next year and beyond is going to be for what's going to stick, what people are going to look at and say, hey, you know, we figured out how to do such and such through a computer wire. Why don't we just keep on doing that? And then we see, okay, these other things that we had to do through a computer wire, that sucked. Let's stop doing that.
I think it opens up companies, right? It's like, how much of your workforce, you know, your company, we were talking earlier too, it's like 3/4 of them live elsewhere. They don't live in Texas, right?
Yeah, we don't have a nucleus at headquarters anymore like we did, you know, 7-8 years ago. We're spread out.
I was just reading I read a headline to an article this morning that says people, you know, there was this transition of, you can look at downtown Austin, great example, right? The amount of density that the downtown Austin area has had in the last 12 years has gone up, I would say exponentially. It's huge. The number of giant apartment buildings down there has gone up a lot just in the last 5 years.
Yep.
But now with people being able to work at home, people are migrating back out to the suburbs where the housing is cheaper. And you don't have to commute anymore. You know, my commute's
right.
14 steps up a stairwell and I'm in the office, right?
Right.
And so there is an ad. That's one of the parts of the new normal too, is that you can, your workforce and the ocean of candidates to go work with you has gone up worldwide now, right?
Right.
You don't have to live in the Bay Area anymore to work for whatever company you want to work for. You can work wherever. You know, I'm having a call yesterday with a person that lives in Mississippi that works for Amazon on their Amplify product.
Right.
Right. And it's like, you know, I have friends that work at Amazon that live, I mean, Eric Anderson, a mutual friend of ours, he works at Amazon, right? And he lives, you know, 5 minutes from us. So it's the universe has contracted and expanded at the same time, right? It's your universe has grown. Your pool you can draw from is huge. And the companies that are smart will take advantage of that. And the companies that are not will go back to the old ways where they make their employees show up at the office every day and limit what they can do. So,
well, if you think about it, it just, if someone was downtown or at a city center and then they realize, okay, our people don't have to commute into the city center, wherever that is. And then you realize, okay, we've gone 9 months like this and maybe we'll continue not having people come into the office. Well, once you've gone a significant period of time without people physically coming into a space, what if that employee had moved to another state? Would you have noticed, as long as they're working the same time zone schedule as your headquarters?
Right.
And at that point, logically, it's like, okay, they live in a suburb and they don't commute in versus they moved hundreds of miles away. It just ceases to matter so much.
Right. I mean, you know what business I would hate to be in right now? The office space business.
Oh, well. Well, office space business, yeah, because a lot of people, a 3-year lease is kind of like the low end, not subleases, but 3-year leases. And so some people are locked in, but there's going to be this avalanche of people not renewing their leases.
It was Spotify or Snapchat. They paid $95 million or some ridiculous amount to get out of a downtown lease in San Francisco. Mm. They just paid, they bought it out. We're done. We're not moving in because they might as well just get rid of the money and cut the expense. And then, I don't know. It's a good time to be a software developer. It really is. So, or in DevOps or in database work, whatever you do, it's all, this is, we're in a good period for us at this point. So, and we're lucky. And then we, you know,
haven't we said that our entire careers though? It's a good time to be a developer. I mean, come on, in the late 90s, you had the internet boom and it's like, it's a great time to be a developer. And then we had Y2K. It's a great time to be a developer. And then we had the early 2000s. It's a great time to be a developer. I don't think we've had a development drought.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's always more work to do than people to do it, you know, or than good people to do it for sure.
So. I take that back. There was I think in 2009, there was a little bit of stagnation, lasted for what, half a year? A year?
Yeah, not long. I mean, the economy did what it did and then it came back. You know, we're very resilient here.
Definitely. Well, one of the things, just kind of being, you've done some smoking with a Traeger.
Yep.
That's a high-tech smoker right there.
I've gotten actually pretty good with the stupid thing. I never thought I'd, you know what, when you live in Texas, you learn to love brisket, and then there's like different levels. So I think at a certain point, it's like, hey, maybe I can do this. And I watch all these other nerd friends of ours. They do this, like Jimmy Bogart. He is my mentor. I actually watch him on Twitter all the time. And he makes some mean briskets. And I'm like, yep. I bet I can do that. So we got a Traeger, and I've done four or five. I do ribs more or less because ribs are, you know, that's a good 6 hour cook, and briskets take a long time. But yeah, I enjoy it. It's you get up really, really early in the morning, and there's the knowledge on how to make brisket is free and out there. Like,
yeah,
Aaron Franklin, who is, you know, they go back and forth. There's a barbecue place out in Lexington called Snow's. And Aaron and Snows, they go back and forth on the number one in Texas. He has entire videos on Masterclass and other things where you can watch him make brisket and he shows you how to do it. And I was watching this documentary with the people out at Snows, and they're like, everybody in Texas will show you exactly how they make the brisket. And then they'll say, yep, good luck. Aaron Franklin does salt and pepper. That is it on his meat. How it's trimmed, how you watch it, the temp. I mean, there's all these variables that go into making this really poor piece of meat into something amazing. And it does transform after 14 hours. That tough, leathery piece of meat turns into something that you can cut open with a fork. But
yeah,
it's very enjoyable. I enjoy the process because it's a lot of care, and it's time and figuring it out and trying new stuff. And yeah. That's a lot of fun. I enjoy barbecuing. And with that's the other thing too, with the whole thing that we're going through, we cook at home a lot more. So it's really nice to go, let's have a barbecue and make our own stuff and figure out how to do it. You know, go to the good old HEB and pick up a brisket, trim it up and put it on there.
Well, and I'm just getting more into that space. But when I found out that you're kicking back, looking at the app on your smartphone, checking the temperature of your smoker, I'm like, okay. It's a whole other story.
Yeah, I'm a little more old. I'm looking into one of those digital things. I don't even do that. I just go out and check it and, you know, poke your finger into it and see where it's at and the whole bit. And then my meat thermometer is one of the old Rudy's turkey thermometers that we get from Thanksgiving when we get a smoked turkey from Rudy's. For those of you that are not in Texas, Rudy's is a barbecue place here. So,
yeah,
it's a good little place.
Yeah. With the whole, the quarantine and then some of the big meat processors kind of closing down for a little bit, the meat price is starting to go up. And so a couple months ago, I made a steer order and a hog order directly from some ranchers just to fill my freezer. And because that's the first time I'd ever done it, rather than going to, you know, HEB or grocery store, meat market. And the price per pound is just insanely different. I'm thinking, shoot, why would I ever go back to a grocery store for meat again?
Yep. But you have to buy a freezer.
Yeah, you got to buy
a deep freeze. That's not exactly a small purchase, man.
Well, no, it's not. We asked. We do. Well, in Texas, they're not hard to find.
Right.
There's tons of people that have, you know, a few dozen head of cow, and you just like talk to them, say, hey, when are the calves full grown? And they tell you this, hey, can I reserve one? Sure, no problem. And so you go in with, you know, a friend or two friends, you know, a half or a quarter. We asked for one of the smaller ones. So it was just shy of 400 pounds of meat from half. So that means that it was between 700 and 800 pounds of meat for the whole steer. It was a smaller steer. You know, obviously the big ones that go to the national meat packing plants are 2000 something pound animals. And that's where you get the, those full beef ribs that are like Flintstone, you know, dinosaur beef ribs.
Barbecue places around town that sell them, but that's a treat. Those beef ribs you get at the barbecue places here are to die for.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, to have your wallet die as well.
Oh yeah. No doubt.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
So let's get into tech a little bit because you're working with a few interesting things that are new. Namely, you've been into databases your entire career, but it piqued my interest when you're working with the Snowflake database engine. Tell us, what the heck is that? There's a lot of people that hadn't even heard the term.
So, we do a lot of analytical work, and Snowflake is a, it's a cloud-based database. It's essentially just think of a giant SQL server in the cloud. And the guy one of the people that started the company is Bob Muglia, who used to be at Microsoft and who was in charge of like Visual Studio and stuff like that for a while. And maybe SQL Server. I'm not quite sure of his history. But anyway, it's a really weird model. You have your tables and your views and your select statements and the whole bit. But what you don't have is you don't have any real way to tune your database. You can't build extra indexes on it. It's very limited in what they do. And the way that you pay for it is you pay compute. So in other words, it's an exponential 1, 2, 4. How many CPU units do you want to throw at your query? And you can, as your workload goes up and down, you just turn the meter up and your database performs faster. And this thing's lightning quick. It's very, very fast. But you don't have any really major options. The weird thing of it is that in the last year, I have become proficient in a file format that you'd never know is the lingua franca of moving huge amounts of data around. I am a CSV file expert in terms, because that's how you load everything into this thing. What you do is we get data extracts from all over the place. You build CSV files. You can gzip them in all bit, and then you load them into an S3 bucket in Amazon. And they actually will support Azure and other stuff. So a lot of my clients use AWS, but it's really, you can still pull them out of the equivalent of S3 in Azure. So you load these CSV files up there, and then you issue certain commands, and it loads a million records in this database in seconds. And it just does it really fast. I don't know how they do it. And then you pay for storage. The storage is essentially S3 costs, which is nothing, you know, storing huge amounts of data is nothing. But we've learned how to navigate through that whole process. There's some really good .NET tools for building these files and mapping them and all that. So we've become very proficient in that. And then we build these, we use Tableau or BI, Power BI or whatever to query the data and visualize it. And they're just, and it's weird as it's a SQL, it's very familiar in terms of SQL syntax. They also have the ability to build data lakes where you can shove raw JSON data into it and you can query off of nodes in your JSON data, and they've optimized the heck out of that. So this, and it was actually interesting because I think about 2 weeks ago they went public and it was the biggest IPO going around. So it's kind of good to know that they're at that level, but they're not free. It's not cheap. I don't pay for it, but they have models if you want to learn. If you want to learn it, I think this is the way to go. The other interesting thing about it too is that we have other clients that my client has other clients that they work with, and they have their own Snowflake databases and they have a whole sharing model. So I can say, I have this whole repository of my data that I want to share with you so you can do analytics processing on my data. And you just create a database in your platform that essentially has links to theirs in whatever mode they want to give to you. And then you can put that in your pipeline process as well. So it's been pretty interesting. That's kind of that's been a huge amount of my time over like the last year and a half, is learning how to deal with Snowflake and becoming proficient in that tool. So it's a growing market, and it's these online cloud data. And it's not like your Postgres in the cloud or your SQL Server in the cloud. It's more like Redshift in Amazon, if you're using that. Is there an equivalent to Redshift in Azure? They have something like that, or is it pretty much a SQL Server?
I think it's just different flavors of SQL Server.
Yeah.
Whether it's the Elastic Pool or a standalone database.
Yeah.
With Snowflake, what was the selling point where you said, hey, I think this is going to be a better option for this type of software or this type of database?
We decided to move into the cloud. Well, actually, another client that was using it. And then they granted us access into their database. And it's like, this is very interesting. This looks like a good way to do it. The main impetus for it is, when you're dealing with lots of people, it's easier to put your database and data up in the cloud, and then you can share it across things. It's actually it's an easier vector to get at data rather than local, in my opinion. Lots of applications tap into it. So I think it's the scalability of it was another aspect of it we found interesting. And we looked at Amazon Redshift, but I didn't like their technology, their underpinning of their technology. I thought that the solution that Snowflake had was a lot better. The syntax was more, we do a lot of SQL Server. And so their flavor of SQL is very, very similar to SQL Server syntax. But the main aspect of it that I really like is the ability, when we have big loads that we have to process, we can say, it's like being able to buy a car where the car is like two cylinder when you buy it. But when you want to go really fast down the freeway, you can buy 10 more cylinders and add them on. And then when you're back home commuting, you go back to two cylinders. It's really like that.
Wouldn't that be awesome? Like, cool. For real, in a car, just press the scale up button and toss them another nickel just to have insane brain to the back of the seat acceleration.
Yeah. And then you get Elon Musk riding a, you know, radar masking mode, so you can not get tickled. So you can, as you go real fast.
We would never do that. No. We would never do that.
I never speed.
So let me just hone in, because I've never used Snowflake. The accessing it is a HTTPS connection. Is that
you
right?
You have a .NET data driver. You can just plug into your .NET.
Okay. Direct driver. Okay.
They have a driver that's just like everything else. So it's limited, but it's got, you know, connections and data readers and the whole bit. So we're able to plug that into our data access framework. So you can do that. If you're doing Go, they have drivers for that. If you do Python, they have a Python connector. Or if you want to, you go old school and do ODBC. They have an ODBC driver. So it's very, very, very much just like any database. That's the beauty of it too, is you don't have to train yourself in some new syntax. It's the syntax you already know. If you know insert statements, query statements, update statements, it all works exactly the same way. With some variance, but it's pretty standards compliant for the most part.
What I thought I heard you say was you had a lot of different applications that were accessing it, rather than just, hey, you have one application and then that application's database.
Yeah.
And so did that use case cause you to try to eliminate some pain that you were experiencing with other databases? And you say, this makes that so much easier because everybody needs to get to this thing.
It's mainly the collaboration and scale out of it. It's mainly to be able to just stick the thing up there, point them at a connector, and they can connect out any way they want. Power BI has native connectors to it. Tableau, which is another, it's just all these different tools. It's all our end user audience is people that can write SQL, or people that know how to click and point in a Tableau document or in a Power BI document. So it gives us the best of all worlds. It really works that well. And I love that it's SQL compliant and the whole bit. So
yeah,
we didn't have to relearn everything we already know. And there's different stuff you deal with. It's like your strategy for loading data becomes very different. But the cool thing about that, and this is the thing that's really been interesting, is that I've been able to take my information I've learned in Snowflake and transport it to other technologies. So mainly in Postgres. Postgres has the ability to ingest XML kind of, or not XML, but CSV kind of data in a very rapid fashion. So I have another client where we're on Postgres and we have large amounts of data that we have to move. And rather than doing inserts one at a time, or trying to use whatever bulk way of getting the data in. It's like, I bet I can just, can I import CSV files into the thing? I did some digging. It's like, well, look at that. I sure can. So what I did is it's this whole, boys and girls, CSV is the weirdest thing, that it is the lingua franca of moving data around. If you look at Python, that's how data is moved in Python applications. You ingest CSV files into data frames and in PyTorch or whatever, Pandas, I think is what it's called. It uses it, importing and importing CSV files. And that's always the weird thing to me. It's like, really? We just use this to dump data and import it into Excel over the years, which Excel is the biggest database on the planet. So,
right.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's kind of rambling there, but I actually enjoy the platform, the way that it works, and it just the abilities of it are pretty amazing.
Okay. So, any libraries or tools that you've come to really appreciate for working with CSV files?
Yeah, CSV Helper is my lifeline in the .NET world.
Okay, is that a library?
Yeah, it's an open source library, and it's an amazing piece of work. It's extremely flexible. We've become Jedi masters in how to deal with that thing too, with transforming date fields and numeric values and how we want to delimit our data. And it's got we do a lot of streams. So when you're moving huge amounts of data around, the ability to stream a CSV writer with a gzip tool to zip the data and all that, it's very handy to do all that. And then it's a good tool. And then you can also, when you're dealing with CSV files, you have the columns have to be in a certain order, and you can't rely on your object because you build objects, right? We serialize objects essentially into CSV.
Yeah.
Well, you might add a property at the end. And so where does that file end up in the CSV file? Well, CSVs are ordinal, right? It has to be in the position you insert, right?
Right.
So it's got mapping libraries to tell it, when I export my CSV file, put this column in position 32.
Nice.
And then it goes in correctly. So it's a handy little tool, and we use the heck out of it. We use it for lots of stuff. That's the main one. And then for gzip, we just use the built-in .NET libraries. Those are fine.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And another mutual friend, Jeremy Miller, puts out a bunch of tools. I think you're using Martin, among others.
I love Martin. Martin is a great little tool.
Tell us what that is.
It's Jeremy wrote a tool to store .NET objects, object graphs, whatever, into a Postgres database as JSON and get them in and out with a low level of work. So you can it's a document database built over Postgres and their ability to do JSON. And I'm probably butchering what it all is, but we build large compound documents for one of our customers. They do big companies, they have to vet the people that do projects for them. So are you veteran owned? Are you minority owned? Are you woman owned? Are you a small business, a large business? Can you do government contracts? There's all these, what certifications do you have? So they build these big survey forms, and you have to check all these boxes and sign it and send it in. So we're building a deal where we're able to build that document as an object graph and build the website over it. And then when we save it, we go save the document, and it just does it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we need the document back, we bring the whole document out. It's an object graph all put back together, and it just works. And it's very fast. At least from our experience, we've loaded lots of data into it. And it's been reliable. So it's very .NET. It's link, it uses link syntax for doing queries on it and a whole bit. So it's a cool little tool, and there's lots of document solutions that are out there, Mongo and Raven and all these other different tools. And it's kind of in that deal. The nice thing I like about it is that underneath the hood is a Postgres database. So you can actually tell it when it stores the document that you want it to actually emit other columns with it. So rather than just the JSON blob, you can actually tell it, I want the order ID number and the order date and the customer ID and all that to be propagated into columns as well for performance reasons. So when you're querying it a certain way, it rides a really good line for that type of stuff. So we enjoy it a lot.
Awesome.
And then we still do SQL Server. I mean, SQL Server is, there's lots of that out there, and we still write, we still write lots of stored procedures because that's how we move lots of data in and out of the thing. And we still do, I know you turned me on to Hibernate or nHibernate way back in the day. So we do, we get data in and out of it with Entity Framework, nHibernate, whatever we want, whatever way we want to do it, we do it. So it's nice to have the. There's an old story called the curse of choice, right? I mean, there's an old example where they set up in a supermarket and they had 32 different kinds of jam and nothing sold really well. And then they cut it down to 5 and things moved very quickly. I think it's in The Long Tail, Chris Anderson's book, where he talks about this experiment. I think that's the book it was in. Anyway, it's nice to have the choice, but we live in the curse of choice, right? It's like, look at the cloud stacks.
Yeah.
Right
now. Oh yeah.
Pick. What do you want to do? It's like, I don't know. Which one of these? Amazon and Azure, I think they have, what, about 14 different kinds of database flavors between them all?
Yeah.
And then the old school ones. You want MySQL, SQL Server, Postgres, whatever. You want to, and those are quote-unquote old school, right?
Right.
So we live in a weird, you know, we have lots of choices. So it's kind of fun. You know, I'm enjoying the renaissance of this stuff we're in.
And, you know, after a little bit of experience, if we have too many choices, we realize, and it's okay to say, hey, I have a certain problem set. Well, what are you going to pick in this area, like the database? Well, this whole list of options would probably do this particular job just fine. So pick one. It's going to be on other factors. And you know what? It's perfectly fine to say architecturally, all these options would work for this particular problem set, but because my team is most comfortable with option, you know, B, okay, that's the one. Because so there's all kinds of factors, but you mentioned stored procedures. We used to, as an industry, we used to have heated discussions over stored procedure versus ORMs, and I had arguments, and I realized, wait a minute, I didn't have enough perspective to be qualified in making that argument. And now I realize it's the same old thing of how close to the data do you want the processing? And you know, if you were to call a web service just to suck over a bunch of data, process it and put it back, there are certain problem sets where you need to do the processing on the same computer that houses the storage. And then furthermore, in some, we need to do the processing in the same memory space as the engine that keeps that data in resident memory. And so, yeah, if it, in some cases, whether you like stored procedures or like SQL or not, it doesn't make sense to pull the data off that box, or it doesn't make sense to even pull that data out of the SQL Server process.
Exactly. So the really interesting thing that I've been watching lots of arguments or in discussions lately around the idea of, and it's a, I don't like the term personally, the full stack developer. It's like, I've been a full stack developer since the day I walked. No, it does exist, because if you're building any kind of user interface ever, you're a full stack developer, right? I don't know that, okay. I don't know too many developers that are immune from the back end of what they're doing, right? You're going to deal with the back end somehow. And I don't know, maybe it's one of those things we talked about earlier.
But what does it mean? I had a recruiter that said, hey, we're looking for a full stack developer. I'm like, okay, you're not, you think that that's all you need to tell me for me to have an understanding of what you're looking for.
The way I see full stack is you build the user interface, you build the back end, and you build the stuff in between. You do it all.
But of what platform combination?
I've been doing this for 30 years. But they say, oh, you can't be an expert in AIM. It's like, well, you can be an expert in enough of it to build apps very effectively, because a lot of us do it and a lot of us have to. When I started out, I was the network guy and the database guy and the developer guy. I did it all, Then I eventually branched out because I liked the software aspect of it better than the networking aspect of it. So you can specialize. And I have friends that's what they've done. They specialized in SQL Server and that's all they do. And I joke, it's like, you go hang out on the other side of the firewall. It's nice over here in the front end too.
Right.
But the thing that we have to understand is that as developers, you know, we talk about these stacks, right, as technologies, and I'm thinking of this one client, of the stacks and databases that we have in there. Mm-hmm. So what do I have in there? I have Snowflake. I have SQL Server. I pull data out of MySQL.
Yeah.
Because we have things that's their data that comes in. We have data that we pull out of Google Analytics via a REST API. We have data that comes out of Foxborough data because we still have Foxborough applications that all these years, they still exist and they still run. So right. just in one client, I've listed five different individual database technologies that we've had to deal with. And that doesn't count any of the code that we write, where we build code in CSS, HTML, Python, JavaScript, FoxPro code still, a little bit of that left, C Sharp, some VB.net, you know, whatever tool was that we had at the time, that's what we're building in. And these things never go away. They just don't. So we're all polyglot. I think no matter, unless you're lucky, you know, but even looking at an organization like Netflix, how many technologies do they have in there? You can't even count.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they have everything.
Yeah. Well, the, I think the term, you're right, the term full stack developer came about and we're like, what? Is this something else that I'm not? It's like, no, I've been working in every part of the quote stack for a long time.
We all did.
But I think the Java, you tell me if you see a different thing, but it seems like there's a, and there are tons of JavaScript, like dedicated JavaScript developers now. And then when they started moving into the back end, they no longer called themselves a front end JavaScript developer. They then started describing themselves as a full stack developer to differentiate themselves from the people that only did the JavaScript front end.
Is that really where that came out of? I never thought about it. Is that because Node.js came along and all of a sudden they can run stuff on the back end? Well,
and I could be wrong, but that seems, at least from my observation standpoint, which is not all knowing, that seems to be where that came from. That if you're not a full stack developer, then you must be a front end JavaScript developer, air quotes. And so it's like, when I hear someone say, I'm looking for a full stack developer, they don't have to tell me anything else. I already know that they have a JavaScript spa heavy application. I mean, because I only hear that term being used in those circles.
Interesting. Yeah, I never even thought about that. That makes a certain amount of sense. I'll have to dig into that term a little bit more and see where did it come from? It probably came off of like the Y Combinator blog or something.
Maybe.
Like
that. Well, I don't hear .NET developers calling themselves full stack developers. I don't hear Java developers calling. I don't hear iOS developers calling them full stack developers, even if they develop their own backend APIs that the app store that the app calls into. I just don't hear that. So, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's always fun to explore stuff, right? That's what makes our industry fun. It's like, well, I'll spend a little bit of time and then I have to get back to get actual real work done. So,
that's right. Well, and we keep on hearing the stats. We've doubled over the last 7 years, and it looks like we're accelerating a little bit from a growth perspective. I mean, there's just so many developers and so much custom software being written. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah. We're building solutions now that we've never dreamt of. And it never lets up. Our software that we build is more complicated, and it's getting easier to build more complicated. And I don't know if that's good or bad. So.
Yeah,
this next edition of .NET is going to be very interesting.
Yes.
No page programs and a lot of stuff and record types and a lot of cool stuff they're doing. It's going to be very interesting to see which of that really rises out to take it over.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
It's interesting because the new single page programs that they have where you don't have to have brackets and all that, it's like, this looks a lot like Python.
Well, yeah.
It's like dead on Python code. Are they going to make a certain denting now a certain way? Like that's the weird one. It's like how you indent. Python is a fun language. I enjoy it. I've done some blog posts on writing .NET utilities in that and in Python to see the comparison of the languages.
Yep.
And it's interesting, but it's like the indention thing is really, it's, I don't want to say odd, it's just different, but it makes sense. So.
Yeah, for sure. It's an exciting time. Well, we've got a lot of stuff to include in the show notes. We'll make sure to include as many links as we can there. But Rod, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate the time.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun. This is fun just kind of to catch up and just talk about stuff. It was very enjoyable. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.